It's time again for the one show that takes a look at business from a different perspective, the coaching perspective, with Master Certified Business Coach, Doug Gefeller. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Paul. Good to talk to you today. Well, look, welcome everybody to today's show. And we do have Michelle Zelnick, who is a business therapist, and he is going to be joining us in just a minute. If you're not listening live, if you're listening to the show through one of our podcasts, well, then thank you very much for visiting our website or our Podbean site, dgefeller.podbean.com. And while you're there listening to the podcast, be sure to check out some of the great shows from the past with some fascinating guests that we've been privileged to have on the show over the many years that we've been doing this. We have been coaching here at the Coaching Perspective businesses and teams in the Orange County area for the last 20 years. Boy, the time is creeping up on me. And we are truly enjoying it. And I say in the Orange County area, that's where I'm located. Not all of our clients are located here. But those that are, I truly enjoy the fact that they're close. Those that aren't, well, it's good to get away from home once in a while. If you are interested in coaching, go to our website. There's lots of information there, and you can take a look and see whether what we have to offer, in fact, would be of benefit to you. Well, look, let me tell you a little bit about Michelle. He is a former CPA, attorney, and clinical psychotherapist who now works as a business therapist. He counsels business owners and families that are experiencing serious internal conflict on how to constructively harness their conflict and get back to business. And boy, I can't wait to talk to him about that sentence. I love the fact that he doesn't just blow away the conflict and say, we're going to make it go away. He talks about constructively harnessing their conflict. You know, Michelle points out that the conflict and misunderstandings commonly occur with business partners and family members. Especially when sharing control, it can be a challenge. You know, we all want to be in charge. And that most partnerships fail due to personality conflicts, not because of business problems. So he says, wouldn't it be helpful to learn why that happens and what you can do about it? And he is going to share some of his secrets on how to successfully deal with partnership conflicts with us today. So let's get right to it. Michelle, welcome to the Coaching Perspective.
Thank you, Doug. It's great to be here.
Well, hey, I'm honored to have you on the show. You've got a busy schedule, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us and share some of your knowledge with our listeners. Look, before we jump into some of the issues that you've outlined here, tell us a little bit about yourself. What did you do before what you're doing now?
Sure. It's been sort of a progression. I grew up in a family business and learned about the importance of commerce and how my father taught me, you know, the elements of making money and running a business. But my first career after that was working as a CPA for what is now one of the big four firms. Then I just gravitated and worked towards working with companies as a financial executive, CFO, controller. Then if that wasn't enough, I took a break, became a lawyer and practiced law, mostly business litigation and commercial law. And then I moved back to being a business owner again when I thought it was a good idea to make money. And so that's kind of how I sort of got to a point where I sort of got to the end or the level or plateau of my business career. After we sold our business, took a break. And thought about what it is I wanted to do, and I wanted to sort of explore the idea of psychology. So typical for me, rather than just reading some books on it, I decided to go back to school again and became a licensed clinical psychotherapist, basically focusing on relationship problems. And for about 10 years, I worked with couples and families, learning about, you know, what nice people do to each other when they get frustrated. And that's kind of how I got to the point and created the foundation for my work now.
You know, before we get on to that, you mentioned twice in there that you sort of took breaks between career paths. How important were those breaks to you?
I think they were very important. I'm a lot of people. I'm a hard worker, and I focus on the prize. And everything I was doing was just based on the thing I'd immediately done before. And so, not that I lost my perspective, but you reach a point where sometimes you have to take a break from what it is you're doing in order to take an inventory of what actually matters to you. And then from that place, you can sort of, you know, integrate what your experiences are and sort of chart a new path forward in a way that's more genuine, more authentic, and less about what other people are thinking and what you've learned as an individual.
I appreciate you sharing that. You know, I see so many people, especially the business owners or the business type A personalities that I tend to work with, that as soon as one thing ends, they're rushing off to the next thing as if it would be sort of a guilty feeling to take a break there and think about it. And I'm glad for you sharing that. I agree with you. I think it's extremely critical.
Absolutely, absolutely. It takes a little bit of courage to get off the treadmill. We focus on success, and we focus on what we understand to be the way things are, and to take a break from it, you know, requires some discipline.
Yeah, it does, and patience. Of course, that's the hard one for me. Well, look, tell us a little bit about your business today as it exists. What do you do? Who do you do it for? How do you find your customers, your clients?
Sure. What I learned is I happen to have a facility for dealing with high conflict situations in a business environment. I started off by doing, when I sort of made the transition from becoming a therapist to becoming a business therapist, I did facilitate group facilitation, leadership coaching, that kind of stuff. And what I learned is I'm really good at this one thing. And this one thing is getting people that are really stuck in strong emotions and getting them to, as you said, harness their emotions to be able to channel them into something positive. So what I do is I work with business owners, family businesses, and professional service firms like CPA firms and law firm partners, where they're stuck. They're either in high conflict, or they're unable to agree or work on anything together, and so the conversation and the dialogue is completely shut down. And what I do is I work with them to develop tools and of self-understanding. I help them learn how to self-regulate. And then from there, we get the conversation going to the issues at hand. And then from that place, I help them usually transition to other advisors who are experts in the areas that they need, as in coaching or tax or marketing or whatever, because now they're able to focus on the business again and not focus on each other. The process lasts about anywhere from 1 to 3 months. We meet with some regularity in that time. And it's amazing when people start to feel more positive about one another and they start changing how they think about one another, how much traction you can get pretty quickly.
You know, just as a curiosity, what kind of ratio would you give to situations where you were able to get them to revitalize their working relationships and go forward together versus those where they kind of realize that it's just not repairable and they have to go separate ways?
That's an interesting question. It probably is 4-to-1 or 5-to-1 for staying together. And it may sound impressive, but in reality, it has more to do with the kind of people that are willing to do the work. For the most part, when people choose to engage me and let me do my work, they're ready to try to find a better way to deal with one another. And every once in a while, the best answer is to separate from each other. Ideally, it's done in a way that doesn't destroy the business and destroy the relationship, which typically we can do.
Yeah, and you know, when I asked that question, I was trying to be very careful to make sure that I didn't imply that one way, staying together, was a success and splitting apart was a failure, because, in fact, the success is just recognizing what works best for both individuals.
Right. I often get the question what my success rate is, and I always laugh when I hear it, because I feel my success rate is 100%, because I eliminate a lot of the signal noise that goes on between and among family members and partners. And from that place, once you get people trusting each other, understanding each other, and able to really connect and communicate with each other, then you're left with the need to make a business case to stay together. And often, despite the fact that maybe they worked together for 10 or 20 years, there's no longer a business case to stay together, and then you have to sort of recognize that and try to figure out what the most, what the best way for them to separate from each other in a manner that does not destroy the business.
Okay. Well, look, there's a question that we've asked every guest that we've ever had on the show, and we never get duplicate answers, so I'm anxious to ask you, and that is, tell us about a particular experience or a key lesson that you learned in life that really sort of set your guiding principle for how you're going to do business or how you're going to live. What would that be for you?
Simply put, it's a great question. Simply put, we all have better or worse versions of ourselves. People shouldn't look at themselves and others in terms of being constant. And stressful situations bring out the worst in us. And what I've learned as a guiding principle is if we can engage with the best version of ourselves to deal with problems, and that would be me, and, for example, if you and I were having difficulties, the best version of me and the best version of you can be engaged in the problem, then those better people are the best people to solve it. When you and I devolve and we're the worst version of ourselves, nothing good is going to come from that. So I joke that I deal with good people at their worst. And in fact, we have to find a way to manage that so that the best version of ourselves, and I'm not saying people that aren't emotional, it's emotional, but the best version of ourselves are available. And when the worst version of us sort of pops up, how to deal with that? Because we can't trust one another if at any point in time you can turn on me due to an involuntary emotional reaction, negative emotional reaction. So for me, the guiding principle is for all of us need to have enough self-awareness to know when the best or worst version of us are in the room and how to summon the best version of us or get a handle on the worst version of us before we get into too much trouble.
Well, you've maintained the record here for 6 years. That was certainly not a duplicate of any answer that I've ever gotten before, and I love it. It's very, very original and makes a lot of sense given the kind of work that you do. You know, I had never heard the term business therapist before. A little background on that?
Yeah, when I, as I said earlier, when I was more of a Swiss Army knife and doing different kinds of things, I just put myself as a consultant or leadership coach. And then I was asked by a colleague one time, or a colleague shared what they thought my answer would be as to saying, well, you bring harmony wherever you work. And I paused for a second. And I said, no, I think my clients actually argue more after my work is done than they did before. They just are able to tolerate it. And as you know, creativity comes from people disagreeing with each other, but with good faith. If we all agree with each other all the time, then it's hard to come up with any kind of creativity or value for people working together. So as I tried to find a phrase to describe what I do, there wasn't one available that I could find. So I started thinking about what I do, and what I do really is therapy. It's not mediation, it's not consulting, but it's therapy around the business, because the business at the end of the day is why we're talking to each other. The business is something special, precious, valuable, something that we need to take care of. And so I felt that the description of my job as a business therapist was more descriptive than anything else I could find.
I like it. I think it is very descriptive. Well, you know, you deal with, let me ask the question, the kinds of companies that you deal with. I mean, obviously they're partnerships or they're professional practices. They're not typically sole owners, I would assume. What else would be the profile of the companies you deal with?
Well, typically it's anywhere from 2 to 15 partners. Or owners. I deal with owners. The typical profile is they've been working together from anywhere from 10 to 20 years. So these are people that have long-standing relationships and have historically found ways to either solve their problems together or have just sort of put them aside and they've not been unmanageable. My typical client is literally between 40, 50, or 60, sort of at a certain stage in life where their tolerance for difficult situations becomes, you know, less and less, and they realize that life's too short, and they've tried other things. I'm rarely the first person my clients call. I'm usually the last, And so they've usually tried other things, other advisors, other consultants. They may have seriously considered legal remedies, that is hiring an attorney and trying to litigate the matter, but usually that approach can be quite destructive, both in terms of the value of the business, the value of the relationship, and the kind of commitment required to litigate a breakup of a business or the control of a business consumes you for years, and time is precious. So I'm an alternative to litigation, and more importantly, I can accelerate and create an environment where the right conclusion for all the parties can be arrived at. I don't know if that answers your question.
Right. Boy, it does. It does completely. That's a great answer. Well, what is there any common problems that you deal with? I mean, are they, you know, one-offs, or is there some sort of common thread that you find with business owners when you're called in?
Sure. I find over time that they usually come down to three themes, and I've been doing this for years, and I've dealt with hundreds and hundreds of clients over that time. One is the idea that one or both of the parties or all the parties feel underappreciated. And you think that that's kind of a trite issue because we're all adults here. But in fact, that can really grate on somebody when you're doing something and you don't feel like it's being appreciated. The second one is, and the most common, is just an imbalance between what you feel you're contributing and what your compensation is. I deal in the world of mathematical impossibilities where everyone thinks that they're contributing more than their partners. And, of course, that's mathematically impossible. But that's the person's experience. And this happens, you know, with the best of intentions because circumstances change, people change. If you think about any relationship that you have over a long period of time, the circumstances change. And if the contract or the agreement between the parties doesn't change and reflect and isn't flexible, you end up with that sort of sense of frustration and imbalance where I feel like I'm contributing more than you and my compensation doesn't reflect it. And in fact, if I even agree with you, I'm not going to even start that conversation because if you and I talk to each other, I'm going to get less. So I don't understand that by stonewalling you, I'm actually creating a bigger problem for myself. But that's what happens. And the third thing that comes up is just a lack of confidence in one another. Often what is experienced is you don't feel your partner is taking care of you. And it's interesting when I sit down with clients and I look at one or the other and I just frame it that way, that one of the reasons that one of the partners is trying to take control is because they feel like their other partner is not taking care of them. And when you think about sharing the wheel or sharing a business, sharing a bank account, you want to feel like the person that you're with, you know, has your back. And if you don't feel that and you start getting emotional, it's going to turn negative.
You know, that I sort of hear what you're saying, but I guess you took me by surprise there. I have difficulty picturing two partners in a room, two experienced businessmen saying, I don't feel like you're taking care of me. I mean, how does that show up in terms of issues for them?
What it does is what the experience of the other partner is that you're just taking care of your needs, your economic needs. You want to control your risks, and in doing so, it's at my expense. I don't use that expression until things get pretty raw. But invariably, when you get through all the control issues and all the tension and all the fighting, often the central organizing principle behind it all is a sense that your partner is in it for himself or herself and not in it for the team or for you. And it's a scary thought to share a business with somebody who you don't trust to consider you in their actions.
Yeah, I can see that. I have seen that. When you're dealing with partners, you mentioned you work with family businesses. Do you see a difference when you're dealing with family partners that are having issues and when you're dealing with partners that aren't related and having issues?
There are differences, and there are good and bad differences. But invariably, in a family business, you're dealing with multiple relationships because at one moment, you're my brother. Next minute, you're perhaps my boss. Next minute, we're just employees. These are very dynamic relationships, and you have to keep your roles separate and clear at any point in time, particularly when you're dealing with what we call intergenerational issues. You have a father, a mother working with a son or daughter. One minute, this person's my dad, the next minute this person's my boss. And they're all real issues and they're all real roles, but they can be confusing when we're sitting back and discussing managing the business, compensation, you know, those kind of things too. The part that's interesting with family businesses is it's also, while it creates a lot of tension and confusion, it's also the glue where people hang in there longer than they might otherwise if they were just working due to economic relationships. So family relationships are complicated. They create a fair amount of tension. At the same time, they do motivate people to try to find ways to work with each other.
You know, I'm kind of fascinated by the dynamic of the multi-generational. I mean, you know, we talk so often in the workplace about how does the senior managers handle the millennials or the younger generation. And when you compound that with a sort of ownership investment, what kind of advice would you give to, you know, generally to families where they are bringing in younger members to partner in the business?
I think the younger generations, and they're almost, I look at it in terms of three buckets. You have the you know, the 60X-year-olds, the 40X-year-olds, and the 20 to 30X-year-olds have a really different view of the world. And almost to the point where you have old school and current. And the thing I see a lot of is just simply a misunderstanding on the part of the first or second generation as to the values of the third generation or the people that are 20 and 30 years old, where they have a much shorter view of time. They are not as troubled by uncertainty in the future, and they learn different lessons from the ups and downs of the economy. And so I often see a frustration on everyone's part as the younger, and I say younger, it could be 30, 35, 40, younger people in these sort of family businesses don't seem to take their responsibilities seriously, when in fact they do, they just have a different relationship to the future and uncertainty. Those of us that are over 50 have been through a couple of downturns, and the lessons we've learned are just, you know, stow away your eggs, stow away your nuts and all this and that. Younger people don't necessarily draw the same thing from the last economic downturn. And I've noticed that that tension is really misplaced, that there's just a lack of appreciation and understanding of what the younger people have to offer and what drives them. And rather than competing with one another, the parents of the second generation need to be thinking in terms of understanding what motivates the younger members of the family and accept it and harness it, because they also bring a certain kind of energy to it as well. It's just confusing for us old school people that simply have learned to just roll up your sleeves, and when things are hard, you work harder.
Okay, we're back with Michelle Zelnick, a business therapist who's talking to us about business partnerships and family businesses and why they fail and what you can do about it. And this is great advice, Michelle, and I appreciate you sharing it with us. You know, you were just talking before we took the break for the commercial about the issues of younger generation coming into the family ownership of the business and the problems that the parents have with dealing with this younger generation. Are the issues pretty much the same when two existing partners, let's call them founding partners, now bring in some younger blood, some new partners?
It's an interesting twist, because it's a different contract. You and I go into partnership with each other, and we create something, and we don't know if it's going to work or not. We operate in good faith. We go through the good times and bad, and assuming that things don't descend, we are not competing with each other. When you start moving down a generation, it becomes more competitive. And that sort of, it creates a tension, both in terms of who's taking care, whose kid is contributing what, and also often between the second generation participants in the business. That's pretty common, and especially since that 50-50 partnership, let's say, or that equal partnership, or whatever the status quo, was negotiated by the first generation up front. The next generation they're inheriting a relationship. It's not a contract that they made among and between each other. And you can't assume that they're just going to take it the same way. often partners that have worked together for a long time have sort of worked out what they need to work out, including what they do when they get frustrated with each other. It's been sort of developed over time. The second generation, unless it's managed proactively, and they learn how to deal with frustration and the stuff that I often do with my clients, that kind of ease is not necessarily there when you just simply give them a business card or give them a responsibility within the business. And different children have different talents, and some are better than others. And it brings a level of uncertainty and a lack of time and grade in that space it's an issue that just needs to be managed proactively.
Do you ever get brought into situations, let's say, before they become a problem? So you've got a couple of partners that are looking at adding a new partner, and they can pretty much anticipate that, you know, there's going to be a learning curve here. Or are
Absolutely.
You typically the emergency ambulance that pulls up at the end?
It's sort of there's two things I've concluded. The first one is I'm a little bit like a fireman. For the most part, people will not pay me to go around their house to say what it is they need to do to prevent a fire. But once there's a fire, I'm the first person they call to come in and put the fire out.
I love that example.
And it's just the way it is, because most people don't appreciate how possibly dangerous situations are, just because they have tolerated it. But as I said earlier, people reach a certain age and stage where stuff that they used to be able to tolerate, they just can't anymore, and it always comes as a surprise to the other partner. The kind of gig, as I call it, that you just described are my favorite kinds, because I've developed these tools to rebuild trust, and rebuilding trust is far, far more difficult than building trust. And so these tools are particularly valuable if trust hasn't been broken. And it creates a sort of resilience between partners, between and among partners. I often say, because I take my clients through what I call business relationship boot camp early on in my work, as we develop that vocabulary and a way to deal with frustration and self-regulation, everybody should know this stuff. Every single person should be, who's in partnership or sharing the wheel with anybody, should know these fundamental principles so that they can focus on prosperity, they can understand where they get tripped up and what they can do about it in advance. There's nothing better than to be able to strongly disagree with somebody and not have things devolve.
Were you going to share some of those with us today?
Absolutely. I've sort of learned over time that there's five things you can do and should do when you're either building trust or rebuilding trust. The first thing is, it sounds silly, but slow down. When we get upset or frustrated, we speed up. And that process, that neurobiological process, is our little lizard brains take over. And what I mean by the lizard brain is there's a part of our neurobiology that sort of develops when we're still in our mother's womb, and it's the survival part or the lizard brain part, and it's focused on really one thing, which is survival. And then we have the human brain that sits on top of it, or the more advanced brain that sits on top of it, which is what our logic is, and it's the stuff that we're paying attention to. But our lizard brain's on all the time, and it's basically scanning the world for danger. We don't generally experience it unless we're tired or frustrated or like that. And then the part of our brain where the wisest part of our brain is the prefrontal cortex. And do you want to guess at what age the prefrontal cortex actually matures, where you can actually count on it, and it's where our wisdom is, it's where our perspective is, it's the part of us, it's the Tom Brady of our brains that can just simply knows what to do and is the wisest part of us.
I'm going to guess 30s.
That's unusual that you would be that insightful. It's actually in your mid-20s, and most people guess between 5 and 15. So. And you have a part of your brain, the prefrontal cortex, that basically is the thing that keeps a perspective. And the prefrontal cortex disengages from the rest of our brain when we're tired, we're frustrated, or we've been using it for too long. So if your prefrontal cortex goes away, who's driving you? Who's driving your brain?
I've got the lizard, I assume.
your lizard driving your brain. The trouble is the people around you don't know your lizard's driving, because unlike the movie Big, you don't actually change your body. But you still have the ability to argue. You still have the ability to reason. The trouble is you're not being wise. And that's the time when you're saying the thing you shouldn't say, where you lose your perspective. You ever had a situation where you said, I'm not going to say it, I'm not going to say it, and then you say it?
I don't want to tell you how many times.
Or you read an email and you get all upset, and then you read it the next day and it didn't even say the thing you read. Or you're really upset about something and you wake up the next day and you ask yourself, why was I upset about that? And that's because the lizard was sort of driving your brain at that point in time. And that's the place where people need to develop a relationship with that sort of part of themselves that are focused on survival, which is often an overreaction. And because of that, and it's lizard on lizard, nothing good happens from that place. So slowing down allows you to focus on managing your reactivity. And then from there, we summon the best version of ourselves, which is our prefrontal cortex. And that's the part that we want to be engaged with the problem. So slowing down, recognizing when your lizard brain is taking over, and then engaging your prefrontal cortex or your wise mind increases your capacity. And you may recall I said that the best thing we need to do is get the best version of ourselves engaged when we're under stress. The problem is when we're under stress, our prefrontal cortex goes away. So slow down is number one. Number two is take responsibility for your own contribution to the situation. So I'm not saying blame. Take responsibility, because this is not about right and wrong. And the fact of it is that the stronger you feel about something, the more likely it is that you're not right and that you're wrong about it, but you feel very strongly about it. So the second thing you have to do is focus on taking responsibility for your situation. And you're taking, and my clients take responsibility for that. You're actually getting control of the situation again, because I'm not looking to you to solve it. I'm actually taking control myself. The third thing is to take the time to understand your partner's issues. Often, most of us don't feel understood. Find out what they care about. Find out what they're worried about. What happens is when we get into lizard mode, we start taking control of the wheel. And when you take control of the wheel, that gets me upset, and I grab the wheel. And in fact, you're probably taking control of the wheel because you're trying to get something done, or you're concerned about protecting yourself about something, but we're not talking about that. We end up by talking about the wheel. So this is not about solving the problem. It's about helping each other solve the problem. I tell my clients, when you're in a hole, most of us as successful people work harder. But when you're in a hole, you don't keep digging. You have to drop the shovel, and you have to help each other get out of the hole. It's hard to understand how important it is that the person with whom you're frustrated is actually the person that's going to help you get out of your problem. You can't do it without collaborating with them. The fourth thing is keep your role separate and clear. In other words, closely held businesses have three roles. There's the owner, that's decided by legal issues. There's the leader, that's more subjective, who's running the show. And then what's the economic value of my services? And with privately held businesses and closely held businesses, that's really sometimes all confounded, right? And then in family businesses, you have a fourth role, which is family. And so you can have a situation where you are taking less of a salary than you're worth because you're the owner, or you're paying the receptionist $100,000 because it's your daughter, right? It doesn't make any sense unless you understand that these are different roles, which you don't run into with large corporations because everything is arm's length. But with closely held businesses, those kind of relationships and those kind of roles tend to be overlap, and that's where people get into trouble. I own 50% of this business, but really I'm not the leader of the business, or I'm the leader of the business, but I own 30% of the business. It's confusing the people when they don't keep those different roles separate and when you're engaging with each other. The last thing is just simply to focus on the future, because most of us are stuck in the past, and our brains are designed to focus on the past. But the fact of it is when we do that, it's really hard to focus on the future. And I ask my clients to sort of treat the relationships like month to month, right, and basically focus on what it is they can do, focusing on the future to sort of get out of whatever mess they're in. So those are the five things that I've learned over time are essential to having a successful ability to have resilience, deal with frustration, and take that frustration and do something good with it.
Those are great tips, and as I've got them, it's to slow down, take responsibility for your own contribution to the problem, take time to understand your partner's issues, keep your roles separate, and focus on the future, if I've got it right.
Correct.
Okay. And, you know, I particularly like the issue you bring up there about keeping roles separate, about the difference between my role as an owner versus as a leader versus what my economic value is that I bring to the company. And I can see that in much of what I do, that many times is the cause for people to feel unappreciated because they're mixing up roles.
Correct. I mean, you and I could be 50-50 partners, right, which entitles us each to decide on the direction of the business and share the profits of the business. But, for example, if I'm doing all the work and I'm worth more, I should get paid more than you. And you would do that if you were an owner, not in the business. You'd be sit back and agreeing with it. But if we're side by side, it just doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
But when people can understand that that as an owner, you know, I want you to be happy. You're my partner, but as an owner, I want you to be happy and working your so and so off so we can generate profits. And you can bring more to the table than me. If I were just the owner, I'd be encouraging you to do that. I have to be able to keep my owner hat separate from my leader and employee hat, because those are different things. My economic value in terms of the contribution of my services may simply be less than yours. It is a hard thing for partners to understand. The ones that do successfully navigate these kind of issues.
You know, and I'm seeing more and more of that these days, Michelle, as many of the clients are maturing and we start to get partners that are wanting to take less involvement in the business. But let's say two partners, one wants to stay involved still full time. And meanwhile, the other one is saying, I'm really only up to half time. Well, now they have to renegotiate that economic value, which they've never
Correct.
Done before because they were equal.
Right. Right. And you'd think that would be an easy thing to do, as you just described it. And it's amazing how often my clients have a real difficulty understanding and applying what you just described. Again, it requires a certain level of maturity. It requires, again, your prefrontal cortex to understand and be wise about the situation. And you want to motivate your partner. Again, you want to take care of them so they take care of you.
What are the early warning signs that somebody should get on the phone and call you?
Well, there aren't really early warning signs, but the signs are if you're having the same conversations over and over again, or your clients are having the same conversations over and over again, and the issues never get resolved, or if things escalate whenever a topic or certain key topics come up, where things just turn into arguments and invariably they leave the room and make everybody uncomfortable, or if it's just a topic that is extremely important that no one talks about because it's uncomfortable, because it's going to require an open conversation and there isn't that level of trust to be able to do that. You need to be able to create a safe space for people to explore all the options and go into that conversation undefended, because you really want to put your best minds at solving this business problem, and a common business problem is about succession. What are we going to do next? Who should run things? How are we going to monetize our respective interests in the business? How do I take care of my future if I'm relying on this business for my income, and it's not worth it if I just sell my interest in the business? Those are important things. Or if there's a downturn, how do we divide the pain? Or if there's or if things are going well, how do we divide the spoils? Invariably, it's about the inability to sit down with each other and disagree with each other in a way that doesn't devolve or doesn't escalate into either separation or arguing.
You know, it all sounds so logical, and yet it, when you're out there in the field, I imagine it isn't all that logical. Well, look, as we're getting ready to wrap up here, I just want to give you an opportunity. You know, I frequently interrupt. Is there anything else that you wanted to convey to our listeners that you didn't get a chance to talk about, or I kind of talked over you on?
Yeah, I would say that my biggest competition are not other advisors. In fact, I use other advisors a lot and depend on other advisors to help my clients and help my work. My biggest competition is fatalism, that people don't think things could ever change. So if you're really frustrated and you just don't see a way out and you've tried everything, don't give up. I think it's real important that perhaps somebody like me can come in and hit the reset button and create an opportunity where your frustration can turn into a solution. Don't give up on each other. Don't give up on the situation. Give it another try, and perhaps you need another resource to help you do that. People give up on situations too easily, or they look at their own way of looking at things too easily, and they don't think out of the box as it relates to how they could possibly solve it to create a win-win scenario.
Okay. All right, so you've sold me on it. How do our listeners get a hold of you? How do they find out more about what you're doing and talk to you about helping them?
Well, fortunately, I have a relatively unique name. So you can either Google me, Michelle Zelnick, and that's Michael without an A, M-I-C-H-E-L, or you can Google the Zelnick Group. I'm based in San Diego. I have clients all over the country, and I would be happy to talk to you or talk to your clients under no obligation. I've never understood why anyone had to pay me to meet them. And then if I feel I can help, then we can discuss how I would go about helping them. If I can help, then I'll be happy to direct them to the many resources I have that might be a better fit for their situation. So go on the internet and Google me.
Okay, very good. Well, Michelle, thank you very much for being with us today, and thank you for joining the Coaching Perspective Radio community.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Doug.
Great. Have a great evening.
You too.
Well, we've been listening to Michelle Zelnick, business therapist, the man to call. You know, who do you call? Not Ghostbusters. Call Michelle when you've got partnership issues that just seem to be going round and round in circles and you can't resolve them. So great to have him on the show today. I hope that you've gotten some good information on this. We will have today's show up on our podcast site very shortly. Not shortly today, but shortly. And next week, Kimberly Rausch is going to talk to us about her new book about coaching, so you don't want to miss that show. It's going to be a good one. Well, look, I hope that you've enjoyed the show today, and that the discussion has provided you with new ideas and information that you can put to use immediately to achieve your goals. Have a great evening.
You've been listening to the only show that takes a look at business from a different perspective, the Coaching Perspective, with Master Certified Business Coach, Doug DeFeller.